From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. About a year ago on this program, we invited plant ecologist Adrian Edwards to talk about firescaping. That's making our homes and neighborhoods more resilient to fires in a world in which blazes are becoming more common. Edwards lives in Chico, California, one of several cities where people were evacuated in 2018 for the Camp Fire, which was the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in state history. And she viscerally recalled what it felt like on the day that the fire began.
And I literally get goosebumps and feel nauseated. And what I was doing that morning, you know, by the time everybody in Chico could see that huge fire plume, people were already in traffic jams trying to get out on the only, you know, one of only two roads. And, you know, they canceled classes and I was going to go to the local Walmart on my way home. And the parking lot was crammed already with people who had nowhere to go and they looked just terrified.
6 years later, it was happening all over again. In late July of this year, just to the east of Chico, the Park Fire began. And it was still burning as we prepared this program, having continued for more than a month and having destroyed hundreds of homes and other buildings. Although thankfully, this time without any known loss of human life. A lot of people understand that fire is an inevitable part of the risk of living in the U.S. West. Fires were burning here long before humans arrived. But Caitlin Trudeau wants people to understand just how much that risk has changed. In some places in the West, she's noted that we are now seeing two additional months of fire weather compared to the early 1970s. Those are days in which the conditions that cause fire, heat and low humidity and wind, exist at such levels that if a fire is started, it's likely to grow and to grow quickly. Caitlin Trudeau is a senior research associate at Climate Central. She's based in Sacramento, where she leads the organization's fire weather research program and analyses of West Coast climate impacts. Caitlin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Caitlin, you grew up in the West in an area in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. You moved around a bit, but now you're not too far away in Sacramento. This is a very fire-prone part of our world. And I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about your first and earliest experiences with fire.
I'm from Placerville, California. So it's a very small town in the Sierra Nevada foothills. People know it as the last stop on the way to Lake Tahoe. But it has a very high risk of wildfire, higher than about 98% of communities in the country. So it is a very fire-prone area. And when I think about my experiences there, I'm about to turn 37, and I spent about 30 of my 37 years there. Fire has been a part of life, but much more in the later part of my life than the earlier part of my life. I think about the first time that I can really remember a huge fire coming through town or close to town. It's a very rural area. Was probably in the early 2010s. Since then, we've seen many more fires, very large fires that have caused evacuations, and people have lost homes, pets, loved ones, everything they own. So it's become a very normal part of life, which I say normal, but in the sense that it's really caused a lot of mental health issues in terms of people just constantly afraid. Every year wondering, is this going to be the year that I lose everything?
I find this so interesting that like when you were a little girl in Placerville, you didn't have this experience, right? It wasn't part of your upbringing. It wasn't like your parents were like, hey, Caitlin, you know, we have to talk about, let's have the fire talk. But that now that's something that parents do with their children in these regions.
Absolutely. And I moved around even around Placerville a lot, but I lived out in a rural part of the community called Pleasant Valley. It's a part of the area that was impacted by the Caldor fire. And so, yeah, I'm used to living out in nature. I'm used to living out in areas where you kind of have to go down one dirt road. That's the way in, that's the way out. But it very much was not a part of my childhood. We did not talk about fire risk. You know, someone who studies climate change, it's really the most, visceral thing I can think of is just how much my community has changed since I was a little girl. It is like a completely different place.
Let's talk about how you got into climate change. Because you had kind of an interesting academic journey. You started at a community college in Folsom, and then you ended up studying for a year in London. This is where you fell in love with geography and climatology. How did that happen?
Absolutely. So I've always loved the environment. I always spent time out in nature, camping, hiking. And then when I finished high school, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I spent many years kind of going down one route, kind of turning around, going down another. And it actually was really funny because I ended up at Sac State and I was really nervous to show my advisor, I think I have like 7 transcripts that I was transferring over. And my advisor, he looked at all my transcripts and he said, you know what, Caitlin, like I look at this and I just see someone who's just on their way to becoming a geographer. And he was pointing out like how many different places I lived, all the different parts of geography that I actually got exposed to in different kinds of classes and areas. And so it was really cool because I really did find myself there. And that really kind of reframed my understanding of what like the experiences up until then had been. And it was at Sac State that I took a class. I think it was called Earth Transformed. And we watched James Balog's documentary, Chasing Ice. And that after watching that movie, I realized that I had to do something related to climate change and that I had to be part of the solution.
When you finished at Sac State, there was this period of your life. You weren't really sure, like, you knew you were going to go into this area, but you weren't sure where. And I need to know more about your mom, because I read this story that when you finished at Sac State, you know, you're like, what do I do? And she goes out and collects a bunch of pamphlets for you for research fieldwork opportunities. And I'm just thinking, okay, like, first of all, pamphlets, like, is that even still a thing? And then also, like, what a cool mom.
She's amazing. So yeah, pamphlets, no, they are not really a thing anymore. But really what she was trying to do, she was trying to just give me different ideas of where I could go. I mean, the world is such a big place. It's really hard to know what you want to do. And there's so much pressure when you get out of high school or even, you know, years later to find that thing. And I wasn't really sure. You know, I had my geography degree. I knew I wanted to do something with climate change, but I just couldn't really think of that next step. And one thing that we had talked about was me going in to get a graduate degree. And she said, well, maybe try to do an experience that's similar to that kind of work so that you might have a better understanding of whether that's for you.
What did your mom do that she knew this? Because this is really astute of her. And something, by the way, like, I think that I'm going to adopt. This is a good lesson for young people.
She would be so happy to hear you say that. Because, you know, we've had a lot of back and forth over my life of times where it's like, she's like, oh, I have this, you try this. And I'm like, just like instinctively, just like, no, I want to do something different. But, you know, when I come back to, I'm like, oh yeah, you were right about that. And so now I'm like, okay, you were right. And she loves to hear that. But she's actually a principal. She's been a principal at an elementary school in Rockland. And so she has been a principal for at least, she's been a teacher or a principal basically almost my entire life. She's excellent and most often is right.
And because she was right, you ended up having this experience in Manitoba, beluga whales, polar bears, but also thinning permafrost.
Yeah. So one of the kind of experiences that I was thinking about doing was volunteering for the Earthwatch Institute. And, you know, I've always loved the Arctic. It's one thing that it's kind of funny now that I focus on fires. People say I'm a fire and ice kind of person. But I've always loved the Arctic. I've always loved when it's cold and snowy and rainy. So there was an opportunity to go to Manitoba, to go to Churchill, and to help study the impacts of climate change on the northern tree line. And so we went and stayed at the Earthwatch Institute's partner up there, the Churchill Northern Study Center. And it was incredible. I think I stayed there for almost 3 weeks, and it was definitely life-changing for sure.
So here is this young scientist who has fallen in love with the Arctic. And as you say, like, now you do fire. We've been doing this show for 5 years. And this year, we've very intentionally focused a lot of our episodes on climate. But one of the things we quickly realized when we began, and this kind of relates to this whole fire and ice thing, is that I would interview like a biologist one week and a spacecraft engineer the next week and maybe like a toxicologist the week after that. But everything, like everything had a climate angle. And so I guess what I'm saying here is that as a climatologist, as you went into this graduate program in Nevada, you come out with a master's degree in climate, you have a lot of opportunities to study really any aspect of the world that you wanted to, and you fell on fire. Why was that? What was that?
So it wasn't necessarily fire that I fell on in particular. When I finished grad school, I was told, hey, it's probably going to be a while before you find a job, so just start applying everywhere. And I think the second job I applied to was a data analyst position at Climate Central. And it was, the job description seemed so perfect. And I remember my mom saying, listen, I know it sounds perfect, but like, you're probably going to be looking for a while. Don't get your heart set on something, because she just didn't want me to, you know, get, but it was like, it was written for me. Like it had all the skills that I had. It had, you know, talked about all the applications I'd been using, and it just seemed really like this perfect opportunity. And so I applied, and pretty quickly out of grad school, I moved to New Jersey to work for Climate Central. And I work primarily on their Climate Matters program. It's a program that produces weekly climate reporting resources for TV meteorologists and journalists and just anyone interested in climate change. And so, I started working on the program, which I love so much because every week we have a new topic. But one of the things that we started realizing was that we didn't have someone who was kind of taking hold of the wildfire part of it. And I was one of the only people that was from the West, and they were like, Caitlin, you do data analysis. You're from the West. Would you want to focus on fire? And you know, here I am all this time later. You know, it's something that I can work on and also just have a very personal connection to. And, you know, all of climate change, and you've kind of just talked about this, but like, people don't really realize just how pervasive climate change is and how it will affect every single thing on this planet in one way or another. And as a geographer, I mean, the big part of geography is kind of understanding that everything is connected. People are connected to the environment. The environment affects us. We affect it. And so this was, you know, coming into climate change, it was a very natural, like, progression. Every single person on this planet has something that they care about that's going to be negatively impacted or already is negatively impacted by climate change.
So let's jump now into the subject of fire weather. I think the people, when they think about the weather that's likely to produce fire, probably very easily we think about heat. And heat is part of this, a very obvious part of this. But so is moisture, and so is wind. And wind is maybe the least obvious, but also, you know, pretty intuitive when you do think about it. But all three of these variables are moving in the wrong direction when it comes to fire risk.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I first kind of came to when I started looking at wildfires is the way we used to talk about fire was a bit different. We talked about fires in terms of the number of total acres burned every year. We talked about the number of large fires every year. And those were kind of the two metrics that people really discussed. And, you know, we realized that we can't really use those metrics to talk about climate change because, you know, we're impacting that data, right? Like, we are setting fires intentionally. We're doing prescribed burnings. We are allowing some fire to burn longer. And that kind of brings you to the B point, which we've kind of had this misunderstanding of the role of fire in our environment. You know, fire is a very important and healthy part of our forest ecosystems out here in the West. Climate change doesn't like start all these wildfires. Like, people start most fires. But there are ways in which climate change is connected, and it gave us a great opportunity to really dig into that. And that's how we got to fire weather. And so, like you mentioned, fire weather is the combination of high temperatures, low humidity, and high winds. And it kind of comes together to set the stage for very extreme fire behavior. And when you talk about fire behavior, there are three main things that are going to impact a fire's behavior. And that's going to be topography, fuels, and then weather. And so what we really do is we really focus on the weather aspect and kind of look at how has climate change impacted these variables and to better understand how it's possibly going to change things in the future.
And you and others have observed that these periods of time in which this third element, you know, topography, fuels, and weather, but this fire weather element, the periods in which it exists have increased. And this dropped me. And I've studied fire weather, but this really dropped me. Has increased up to 2 months in some areas of the country.
Really? I mean, almost every state in the country has had some place that has increasing fire weather trends, which is really incredible when you think about it. I mean, you know, we really kind of split the country in half, looked at the West for a couple of years, and then kind of were like, well, what's going on in the East as well? And I didn't expect to see increasing fire trends in the East, but and they're much more muted than in the West. But there are increasing trends of fire weather in the East, which is, I think, really interesting. And there are, you know, certain hot spots in parts of the East, places like New Jersey, North Carolina, Florida. But really, you see these gigantic increases basically across the entire Western half of the lower 48, which is just truly remarkable. And I'll be clear, this doesn't mean that there's an additional 2 more months of fires. We're really just talking about more frequent days where the conditions are set just right, that really all you need is a spark, whether it's a dry lightning storm, whether it is someone throwing a cigarette out the window, whether it's someone camping who maybe their fire they didn't put out all the way. All you need is just one ignition source, and then the conditions really kind of take over and do the rest.
You were talking about the increases in the East. I've got a data point on this. I was on a study team a few years ago that sought to estimate the increase in the increase in fire weather risk with climate change. And we produced this figure showing where in the world we would see increases at in increments of 0.5 degree of additional warming. And I was looking at that figure this morning, actually, as I was preparing for our conversation, and it struck me that we had this color bar that went from blue to red, blue being areas where fire weather would decrease and red being areas where it would increase. And I realized this morning, like, that was just so silly of us because there was no blue on that chart. And there was added warming really does add risk everywhere.
Absolutely. And I mean, when you think about the core of what fire weather, the really heart of it is temperature, right? So we know temperatures are increasing across the globe because of human-caused climate change, right? So we know that that temperature is going up. Temperature and relative humidity vary inversely. So you know if temperatures are going to go up, then you know the relative humidity is going to go down and it's going to be a lot drier.
We have mentioned, you know, the Western United States is at particular risk. Especially in the northern half of the country, the charts on your new report show this pretty stark difference in risk on either side of the 100th Western Meridian. Can you talk a little bit about why that is? Because as we've said, risk is increasing everywhere, but the higher risk remains on the western side of the nation.
There's different things that play into this idea of risk. There's things, you know, that it's the likelihood, it's the intensity, it's exposure, all these kind of things that kind of come together to like represent what we think of as a risk. And there's different parts of it like you could focus on, like the wildland urban interface is, you know, the part of the parts of the country where the cities kind of blend into nature. It's that kind of transition zone. And that is kind of the area where we see a lot of people building houses, a lot of people moving into areas. And so as more people go into these areas, I mean, people start most fires. So you're going to see probably increased risk of wildfire. But there's also other things as well that impact that, you know. But we've seen fires started by electrical lines. So that is something that's another part of risk as well. There's a lot of different elements, but I think that in the West, you're going to have more fires. In the East, it is much more humid over in that part of the country. So it's going to be harder to get to that really hot, dry, you know, windy place. So it's all these different combinations of, you know, people, where we live, what we do, and just like the weather patterns and the climate of our different parts of our country. Our country is huge.
Okay, so Caitlin, I feel like I ask this question a lot when I'm talking to people about global warming and its impacts. And that is, you know, this is such a dire subject. It seems like the data all points in one direction, and that direction is bad. In your case, it's more fire, more risk, at least for the foreseeable future. And you know, I'm not sure it's good for scientists like you, or for anyone for that matter, to be immersed in bad news all the time. So I want you to talk to me about what gives you hope.
You know, I fully believe with every ounce of me that climate change is the most important issue of our time. But it is very hard to think about this and talk about this all day, every day. It really does take a toll on your mental health because it is such a dire subject. I mean, we can talk about solutions and what we want to do in the future, but people right now at this very moment are suffering because of climate change. And that's a very heavy thing to think about. But I think that the thing that gives me hope and the thing that I'm so grateful for this job that I have is I get to talk to a lot of people around the country, around the world that really care about climate change as well. And I get to help them find data for their stories. I get to help them, you know, pull things together that kind of try to show the human element of climate change, why we should care, why it matters, even if it's not in our lifetime. And I think that while this job also is very difficult on a day-to-day basis, because it is such a heavy thing to think about, it's really the job and the people I talk to in my job that give me hope. And it breathes life back into me.
When we give people things that they can do, that they can concretely do, that helps, right? I mean, I guess that's sort of like the counterintuitive, maybe the ironic thing about this is that as climate change affects more and more of us, and as we become at risk, we have to become doers. But doing is this central element in hope. I live in a forest. I live on a uphill slope with a bunch of forests under me. Like, this is a very fire prone area of the country, and I'm in a very fire prone community. And I know that I can't do everything, but I go out every morning and I clear, or every weekend, and I clear my property a little more. And as you know, I've taken a little more like ownership of that. Like, I know that it doesn't change everything. It doesn't take away the risk, but I feel more confident. I feel more hopeful because I feel like I'm doing something. And I think that's this thing that we can give to people, is the ability to do things concretely to help themselves and their families.
Absolutely. I think you are doing something. Like, clearing the area around your home is a huge part of keeping your home safe when you live in a fire exposed community. You know, like, defensible space is a real thing, and it saves so many homes. You know, I was just reading about, you know, the campfire. It's funny, I started working at Climate Central about a month before the campfire. And one of my colleagues was actually, there was a small group of us, I think there's only like maybe 25, 30 of us at the time. He was actually from Paradise. And so we watched Paradise burn on the TV that day. And there's a lot of places, like, one of the things that really helped people in the campfire was the community park and these areas of open spaces where people could kind of flee to and stay safe in that small area. And so, you know, creating these kinds of areas, these open space areas, these fire break areas, even just clearing, you know, brush around your property, making sure you don't have trees overhanging onto your roof, things like that can save everything that you own and keep people that you love and your pets and everything that you have worked for in your life safe. So I think you are very much doing something. And what you're also doing is talking about it. Like, talking about it matters, and understanding that we definitely have this issue that is so huge and extreme and feels just almost too heavy for any of us to kind of deal with. But the thing is that we're not dealing with this alone. We're dealing with this together as a species. And I think we have such awesome power in that. I guess it's hard to think that, you know, just one person can do something that could fix such a huge issue, but we're not asking any one person to fix all of climate change. We're just saying, you know, this is a problem that affects all of us, and it will continue to affect our children, our grandchildren, and the degree to which it will really depends on what we do now. We all care about shared values. We all have these shared things we care about that we work for every day. And I think we can really find community and build community in that, and helping keep each other safe.
That's Caitlin Trudeau. She's a senior research associate at Climate Central, where she leads the organization's fire weather research program and analyses of West Coast climate impacts. Caitlin Trudeau, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.